Iran says it needs stronger guarantees to have a sustainable deal to revive the JCPOA and calls on the UN nuclear agency to close its, quote, politically motivated probes. Kremlin hails late Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev as an extraordinary global statesman, but says that he was wrong about the prospect of a rapprochement with the West. And 1,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails announce a hunger strike to protest their administrative detention and the regime's violence against prisoners.
Well, welcome to the studios from the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us.
Iran's foreign minister says Tehran seeks stronger guarantees from the U.S. to have a sustainable deal aimed at reviving the 2015 deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks during a joint press conference with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, in Moscow. He said that Tehran is carefully reviewing Washington's response to an EU draft text on reviving the JCPOA. The top Iranian diplomat also urged the International Atomic Energy Agency to drop its politically motivated probes in order for Iran and other parties to reach a sustainable agreement. For his part, Lavrov said the two countries are working to create reliable mechanisms that will allow them to expand cooperation regardless of any diktats from the West. He said that Tehran and Moscow have already identified clear guidelines in that respect. We asked journalist and political commentator Fred Weir to tell us more about the bilateral collaboration between Iran and Russia.
Russia was, of course, one of the facilitators and signatories of the original agreement. It was one of the great examples of cooperation between several different countries in coming together and striking that deal with Iran. And so Russia does have a role to play and an interest in seeing it revived. And hopefully it will be, because the world was a safer place. And the possibilities for Iran to re-enter the global mainstream, the marketplace, also very important. So I think those consultations probably pretty important, getting Russia and Iran on the same page about how to proceed with this American offer. And it does seem like a very optimistic moment. Otherwise, there are several other things. You know that Iran and Russia have recently strengthened their bilateral cooperation economically, strategically. There's a new level there and a good deal to discuss about it. And there was also some suggestion that Iran might play a constructive role in helping to navigate toward some sort of negotiated peace in Ukraine.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has expressed his condolences over the death of former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. In a message to Gorbachev's relatives, Putin described the late leader as someone who had an enormous influence over world history and had tried to offer solutions and reforms. The president said that Gorbachev led the country during a period of large-scale foreign policy, economic and social challenges. In a separate statement, the Kremlin hailed him as an extraordinary global statesman who helped end the Cold War. But the statement said that Gorbachev had been wrong about the prospect of a, quote, rapprochement with the bloodthirsty West. Gorbachev, who died at age of 91 in Moscow on Tuesday, is revered by many in the West. But Russians have divided opinions about his domestic and foreign policies. Russia tightening the screws on Europe's energy supply as the economic battle between Moscow and the West intensifies. The European operator of the Nord Stream 1 pipeline, Entsag, says Moscow has halted gas deliveries to Europe. The Russian energy giant Gazprom is citing maintenance issues for slashing the flow, saying a three-day work is necessary at one of the compressor stations. The corporation says it's cutting off Germany's gas supplies for 72 hours. Germany is calling the decision technically incomprehensible and accusing Moscow of using energy as a political weapon. Moscow argues that the Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine are impeding its normal maintenance and repair work, and therefore causing disruptions to the flow. We reached out to political analyst and author Marcus Papadopoulos to get his take on the latest halt in Russian gas supplies to Europe.
The Kremlin could be issuing a reminder to Germany and the rest of Europe of the sheer importance of Nord Stream 1 in terms of European industries and European domestic households. Europe faces not a disaster. Europe faces a catastrophe which could have been averted, because all that we see today in Europe stems from the war in Ukraine, a war which could have been averted. And now, as I said, a catastrophic economic situation is on the horizon for Europe, in which millions upon millions of Europeans either face the prospect of dying because of exposure to the cold elements, or falling into poverty, or becoming homeless. Trying to isolate Russia in the world economically was a catastrophic decision by the Western ruling elites.
Moving on to the inflation that's happening in the Eurozone, it has hit a new record amid soaring energy prices fueled by the war in Ukraine. Official data shows the annual inflation rate in the 19-member single currency area reached 9.1% this month. The figure has increased pressure on the European Central Bank to hike interest rates to curb prices. The president of the Germany's Federal Central Bank has warned that inflation expectations could become permanently entrenched above the 2% target if such action was not taken immediately. However, some economists have cautioned that inflation could hit 10% by the year end, even if the bank hikes rate. Energy shortages and drought impacting agricultural production have a knock-on effect on food crisis. As many as 1,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails say that they will begin a hunger strike, protest against their detention without trial and the regime's violence against prisoners. Palestinian inmates will begin their strike from Thursday. President Mahmoud Abbas has warned that any harm to inmates would explode the situation further. Abbas underlined that the Israeli treatment of Palestinian prisoners violates international humanitarian laws and the Geneva Convention. On Tuesday, an Israeli court also refused to release Khalil Awadeh, despite being in critical condition after nearly 6 months of hunger striking. Hundreds of Palestinians are held in different jails under Israel's so-called administrative detention policy. It allows the regime to imprison Palestinians without trial or charge indefinitely. They're subject to abysmal treatments such as regular humiliating strip searches and beatings. Let's get more on the story from Mona Kandil, a correspondent who joins us from occupied Ramallah. Mona, at this point, this is quite a number, 1,000 to go on a hunger strike. Is that a record? And tell us what has prompted them to go on such a mass strike.
Well, the main reason for this mass hunger strike this time is that Israel in recent months, let's say, had been transferring and moving veteran prisoners and those Palestinian prisoners sentenced to life sentences from prison to another every couple months, and or even from a cell to another, and changing the access of the prison grounds, let's say. This is very difficult on prisoners who are spending life sentences to be transferred from an area to another. Of course, this would be difficult for their families. They would be deprived from their fellow prisoners because they are the only ones they see behind bars. There is also some issues regarding the basic rights of the prisoners, the lack of prisoners for family visits, inability of the prisoners to phone family members. We are speaking about the only family members like the parents or the children. They are deprived from having phone calls as well. So for these reasons and for the aggressive policies behind bars and the aggression against the Palestinian prisoners themselves, the searches that had been being carried out every night by surprise without letting the prisoners know about the exact time of the searches, the aggression on them. For these reasons, the Palestinian prisoners, all of them, the national movement have decided there would be a mass hunger strike. In the last week, they refused food. All the prisoners, we are speaking about over 4,000 Palestinian prisoners, returned back their meals. But the mass hunger strike will start tomorrow with 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. The number could increase according to the Palestinian Prisoners Commission if the Israeli Prison Administration continue to refuse dealing and negotiating with the prisoners' leaders on these issues. These are basic rights for the Palestinian prisoners. They have the right to at least have good food, have medication, have family visits, making phone calls. All these are basic rights for the Palestinian prisoners behind bars. There is the issue of Palestinian prison Khalil Awadi, as you have mentioned. Administrative detainees go for a hunger strike as their sole option to protest the illegal imprisonment. Palestinians are being held behind bars without charge or trial. This is against the law. Human rights organizations, the international community have repeatedly called on the Israeli regime to either prosecute those administrative detainees or release them. Otherwise, Palestinians go for a hunger strike for lengthy periods in order to protest the illegal imprisonment, like what's going on with Khalil Awadi. He had been refusing food for over 6 months now, and the Israeli regime refused to release him. It's not something new. Every time a Palestinian prisoner who had been on a hunger strike is only being released when he becomes on verge of death.
Well, the request made by the Palestinians is a logical one, either prosecute or release. Why is it that Israel is not even going ahead with a prosecution? It's just kind of a state of limbo that these, I don't want to call them prisoners, but the people that they have, the Palestinians that they have detained.
Well, Palestinians are being arrested and held under the so-called administrative detention. In some cases, the Israeli court or the Israeli regime doesn't have accurate accusations against them, or they hold them for secret information they cannot reveal. So neither the prisoner nor their lawyers know what they are held for in the first place. Sometimes those Palestinians are members of a political faction, or they took part in protests and demonstrations against the Israeli regime. Sometimes there are spies who took part in their, in the arrest, and the Israeli military cannot reveal their sources. So they prefer to keep the prisoner behind bars under the so-called administrative detention without charge or trial for a lengthy time. Some people had been held for 10 years. Every 6 months, their administrative detention would be renewed. Can you imagine if a man would be held behind bars for a lengthy time without knowing what he did in the first place? But in the Israeli law, there is this this term that allows the Israeli military to keep people behind bars under so-called secret information.
Thank you very much for that. Mona Kandil there from Occupied Ramallah. Thank you, Mona. Moving on, Iran hails the restoration of calm to Iraq, reiterating its support for a political solution to the crisis in the Arab country. Iran's foreign ministry praised the wisdom shown by all parties in overcoming what it called the Great Sedition. It stressed that dialogue and adherence to the Constitution are the only way to resolve the current crisis. The ministry also expressed hope that all political parties and movements in Iraq would constructively participate in the political process to pave the way for the formation of a new government. The statement reiterated that Tehran always wants a stable and powerful Iraq that plays a constructive role in the region. The unrest sparked after cleric Muqtada al-Sadr announced that he is quitting politics. One day later, Sadr asked his supporters to withdraw from Baghdad's high-security green zone. The turmoil resulted in nearly 30 deaths. Earlier, we were joined by Navid Behrouz to get his thoughts on the ongoing crisis in Iraq. He believes the prospects are relatively good for the start of talks among the country's diverse political currents.
Recent bloody clashes put Iraq on the verge of an all-out and ruinous war. The crisis has temporarily subsided after Muqtada Sadr urged his supporters to leave the green zone. Currently, the security crisis has ended, but the political crisis still persists. Amid the tensions, Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi has threatened to resign, which is in fact the result of growing criticism over his handling of the crisis in recent days. With the end of the security crisis, there is a relatively good outlook for the beginning of the talks among the political parties to form a government. It is important that the political parties, which want to form a government, satisfy the supporters of Mr. Muqtada Sadr and his political faction. And this responsibility is on the shoulders of those who seek to form the government. Accordingly, they should hold direct or indirect talks with Sadr to resolve this issue.
A new book and UK media reports reveal that a Canadian spy smuggled a British schoolgirl, Shamima Begum, and two of her friends into Syria to join the Daesh terror group in 2015. The book, entitled The Secret History of the Five Eyes by Richard Carbage, accuses London of conspiring with Ottawa to cover up the role of the Canadian spy agency. British media say even the Scotland Yard knew the teenagers were trafficked by a double agent known as Rashid, who worked for both Canada and Daesh before his arrest in Turkey. Shamima was just 15 when she and two others were taken to Syria to join the Tekfiri group. She was repeatedly raped and forced into marriage with a terrorist. Canadian and British officials have not commented on the new disclosure. The latest revelations, however, reopened the debate over stripping Shamima of her British citizenship, as her lawyer argues she was a trafficking victim.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The deadly Israeli wars on Gaza are made possible not only by Western weapons and political support, but through an endless stream of media misinformation and misrepresentation, says Ramzi Baru, journalist, in an article published under the heading Deliberate Misrepresentation. Western media bias makes Zionist regime war on Palestinians possible. Here's more. While U.S. and Western mainstream and corporate media remain biased in favor of the Zionist regime, they often behave as if they are a third neutral party. This is simply not the case. Take the New York Times coverage of the Zionist regime's latest war on Gaza as an example. Its article on August 6 is Israel-Gaza fighting flares for a second day. It's a typical mainstream Western reporting on the Zionist regime and Palestine, but with a distinct NYT flavor. For the uninformed reader, the article succeeds in finding a balanced language between two equal sides. This misleading moral equivalence is one of the biggest intellectual blind spots for Western journalists. If they do not outwardly champion the Zionist regime's discourse on security and right to defend itself, they create false parallels between Palestinians and Israelis, as if a military occupier and an occupied nation have comparable rights and responsibilities. For New York Times and all mainstream Western media, there is no question regarding who the good guys and the bad guys are in that bloody fight. Palestinians, in their view, always have been the West bad guys. Per the logic of their media coverage, the Zionist regime does not launch unprovoked wars on Palestinians and is not an unrepentant military occupier or a racist apartheid regime. This language can only be used by marginal, radical, and leftist media, never the mainstream. The brief introduction of the NYT article spoke about the rising death toll, but did not initially mention that 20 killed Palestinians include children, emphasizing instead that Israeli regime attacks have killed a leader. When the 6 children killed by the Zionist regime are revealed in the second paragraph, the article immediately and without starting a new sentence clarifies that Israel said some civilian deaths were the result of militants stashing weapons in residential areas and that others were killed by misfired Palestinian rockets. On August 16th, the Zionist regime military finally admitted that it was behind the strikes that killed the 5 young Palestinian boys of Jabalia. Whether the NYT reported on that or not matters little. The damage has been done, and that was the Zionist regime's plan from the start. The title of the BBC story of August 16th, Gaza's children are used to the death and bombing, does not immediately name those responsible for the death and bombing. Even the Zionist regime military spokesman, as we will discover later, would agree to such a statement, though they will always lay the blame squarely on the Palestinians. When the story finally reveals that a little girl, Layan, was killed in an Israeli regime strike, the language was carefully crafted to lessen the blame on her, Israeli regime murderers. The girl, we are told, was on her way to the beach with her family when their tuk-tuk passed by a military camp run by the group Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which at the exact moment was targeted by Israeli fire. The author says nothing of how she reached the conclusion that the family was not the target. One can easily glean from the story that the Zionist regime intention was not to kill Layan, and logically, none of the 17 other children murdered during the three-day war on Gaza. Besides, the Zionist regime has, according to the BBC, tried to save the little girl. Alas, a week of treatment and an Israeli hospital couldn't save her life. Though the Zionist regime politicians have spoken blatantly about killing Palestinian children, and in the case of former Israeli regime so-called Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked, the Palestinian mothers who give birth to little snakes, the BBC report and other reports on the latest war have failed to mention this. Instead, it quoted Israeli regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid, who reportedly said that the death of innocent civilians, especially children, is heartbreaking. Incidentally, Lapid ordered the latest war on Gaza, which killed a total of 49 Palestinians. Even a human interest story about a murdered Palestinian child somehow avoided the language that could fault the fabricated regime of Israel for the gruesome killing of a little girl. Furthermore, the BBC also labored to present the Zionist regime in a positive light, resorting to quote the occupation army's statement that it was devastated by Layan's death and that of any civilians. The New York Times and BBC have been selected here not because they are the worst examples of Western media bias, but because they are often cited as liberal, if not progressive media. The reporting, however, represents an ongoing crisis in Western journalism, especially relating to Palestine. Books have been written about this subject. Civil society organizations were formed to hold Western media accountable, and numerous editorial board meetings were organized to put some pressure on Western editors to no avail. Desperate by the unchanging pro-Israel narratives in Western media, some pro-Palestine human rights advocates often argue that there are greater margins within Israeli regime's own mainstream media than in the US. For example, this too is inaccurate. The misnomer of the supposedly more balanced Israeli regime media is a direct outcome of the failure to influence Western media coverage on Palestine and the Zionist regime. The erroneous notion is often buoyed by the fact that an Israeli newspaper like Haaretz gives marginal spaces to critical voices, like those of Israeli journalists Gideon Levy and Amira Haas. Israeli regime propaganda, one of the most sophisticated in the world, however, can hardly be balanced by occasional columns written by a few dissenting journalists. Additionally, Haaretz is often cited as an example of relatively fair journalism simply because the alternatives, including the Times of Israel, the Jerusalem Post, and other right-wing Israeli media, are exemplary in their callousness, biased language, and misconstruing of facts. The pro-Israel prejudices in Western media often spill over to Palestine's sympathetic media throughout the West Asia region and the rest of the world, especially those reporting on the news in English and French. Since many newspapers and online platforms utilize Western news agencies, they often inadvertently adopt the same language used in Western news sources, thus depicting Palestinian resistors or fighters as militants. The Israeli regime occupation army as Israeli forces and Israeli war on Gaza as flare-ups of violence. In its totality, this language misinterprets the Palestinian struggle for freedom as random acts of violence within a protracted conflict where innocent civilians like Layan are caught in the crossfire. The deadly Zionist regime wars on Gaza are made possible not only by Western weapons and political support, but through an endless stream of media misinformation and misrepresentation. Though the fabricated regime of Israel has killed thousands of Palestinian civilians in recent years, Western media remains as committed to defending the Zionist regime as if nothing has changed.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Respected brothers, sisters, mourners, lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, may Allah reward you for your participation in this gathering. Truly, we are blessed and honored to be invited to such a gathering and to receive the blessing of being amongst such a gathering. In the Quran, the dua says, Rabbi awzi'ani an ashkura ni'mataka allati an'amta alayya wa ala waliday wa an a'mala salihan tarda. O my Lord, inspire me, allow me to be thankful for the blessings that you've given me and my parents, and allow me to act upon them in a way that you are pleased with me. So we hope that inshallah these blessings can be appreciated, recognized, and acted upon. Like yesterday evening, I'd like to begin this speech with going to a story of one of the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, taking a lesson from that story and then inshallah applying it to our discussion about leading a lifestyle of the Ahlul Bayt, leading a lifestyle of Imam Hussein, leading a Husseini lifestyle. The story I'm about to tell is about a companion who is probably lesser known. Oftentimes, he's not talked about, but just like with all the other companions, he has a story and he is among the Shuhada, and there's something that we can take from his story. His name is Yazid ibn Ziyad, not Yazid the Khalifa, la'anatullahi alayh, but somebody else whose name happened to be the same as the name of the Khalifa. His name was Yazid ibn Ziyad, and not Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad either. The names sometimes are the same, but the people are different, and doesn't mean that they are related with each other. Now, he was an archer, and he was very skilled at archery. He was part of the army of Umar ibn Sa'd. He was with the Kufan army. He had been dispatched from Kufa to actually go and intercept Imam Hussein alayhi salam, not allow him to go to Kufa. And eventually, you know, he goes along with the army to Karbala. Just like everyone else, he is listening to the khutbas of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He's hearing his words. He's being affected by them. He is an observant person, so he sees the difference. On one hand, you have Umar ibn Sa'd, and he sees his leadership style. He sees how, what kind of values he holds as important when he's a leader, and he compares them to the leadership style of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And then you know how on the day of Ashura, Hur ibn Yazid al-Riyahi, Hur, he gave a speech to his own army before he went over to the side of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. They say, at least in some reports, that that speech was very effective. And one of the people who was affected by it was none other than one of the chief archers of Umar ibn Sa'd's army. This man named by the name of Yazid ibn Ziyad. And so he's going through this type of transformational process, not unlike Hur. And he decides that truth is with the side of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He makes the journey over to the other side, to Imam Hussein, and he joins him and his army. And on the day of Ashura, this man is somebody who really contributes with everything that he has. They say that first he went into the battle and he fought until the enemy came and they cut off the legs of his horse. So he didn't have any way of moving forward on his horse anymore. So what he did then is that he came back to the army of Imam Hussein. He goes down to his knees and he takes out his bow. And he begins to fire the arrows. And he was counting. He fired 50 arrows. Only 5 of them missed the target. 45 hit their targets. And all the while, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was praying for him. Allahumma saddid ramyahu. Waj'al thawabahu al-jannah. O Allah, make his archery like firm and make him hit his target. And make his reward be paradise. Now, when he then runs out of his arrows, then he stands with his sword and he is now going to the final battle. The Maqatil, the books of history which record what happened on the day of Ashura, they quote the poetry that he said. So one of the lines he says is this. He says, Ya Rabbi, inni lil Husayni nasirun. O my Lord, I am for Hussein a helper. وَلِبْنِ سَعَدٍ تَارِكٌ وَهَاجِرٍ. And I am for Ibn Sa'ad. I have left him aside and I have gone away from him. I'm cut off from him. Now, in the story of this man named Yazid, again, not that Yazid, but this one who became one of the Shuhada of Karbala, we see something which is very much part of what Karbala and Ashura is about, and something that, practically speaking, we who are remembering this and mourning for this, we can take from it, which is the movement and the transformation, the ability to change, the ability to go from one thing to another. Why is this relevant to our topic? Yesterday, we spoke about the importance of lifestyle. And we said that there are different lifestyles that somebody can have even though they're part of the same community, the same culture, the same society. And that's one of the recent developments in modern times. You can have two different neighbors who have two different lifestyles. That gives us the freedom. It gives us the freedom. We can have our own type of lifestyle. But the question is, what lifestyle we should choose, and how should we get there? And of course, we want to choose the lifestyle of those who have been given to us as our guides, which is the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. But it's not just as simple as saying that, okay, now here's the principles by which the Ahlul Bayt taught us to live our lives. Go ahead and let's go and act on them. Because in order to be able to adopt principles, be able to like take on new ways of living perhaps, or maybe if we're already living these ways, then inshallah, that's great. But in many cases, maybe where we are, it's not where we want to be. So either we want to get to that or we want to at least improve if we already are adopting these principles. But in order to get there, we have to first be able to go from where we are. We need to be able to transform. We need to be able to change. So before talking about what sort of things we want to be adopting, what are those principles, first I want to talk about this process of change. We see in that example of the companion of Imam Hussein, he was able to change. But for the most part, the people were not able to change. There were those who, they say, they were crying because of what was happening to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam in the battlefield in Karbala. They were there and they were crying. They were making dua. They were saying, "Oh Allah, do something here. Do something to prevent these people from killing the family of the Prophet." They knew the Quran. They had memorized the Quran. But they couldn't change. They could not change. They could not walk over and join the side of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So when it comes to the idea of taking on a new lifestyle or changing some of our lifestyle habits, and inshallah we're going to get to some specific suggestions, the first step though is recognizing what is it that we're already doing? What are we committed to? And in some cases, identifying it and then moving away from it.
Swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
A new scientific study has discovered that melting of Greenland ice cap will contribute a minimum rise of 27 centimeters to sea level, regardless of what climate action is taken. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment editor, Damien Carrington. The piece is titled, "Major sea level rise caused by melting of Greenland ice cap is now inevitable." Major sea level rise from the melting of the Greenland ice cap is now inevitable, scientists have found, even if the fossil fuel burning that is driving the climate crisis were to end overnight. The new research shows the global heating to date will cause an absolute minimum sea level rise of 27 centimeters from Greenland alone, as 110 tons of ice melt. With continued carbon emissions, the melting of other ice caps and thermal expansion of the ocean, a multi-meter sea level rise appears likely. Billions of people live in coastal regions, making flooding due to rising sea levels one of the greatest long-term impacts of the climate crisis. If Greenland's record melt year of 2012 becomes a routine occurrence later this century, as it is now possible, then the ice cap will deliver a staggering 78 centimeters of sea level rise, according to the scientists. Previous studies have used computer models of ice cap behavior to estimate future losses, but the physical processes are complex, and this leads to significant uncertainties in the results. In contrast, the study published in the journal Nature Climate Change used satellite measurements of ice losses from Greenland and the shape of the ice cap from 2000 through to 2019. This data enabled the scientists to calculate how far global heating to date has pushed the ice sheet from an equilibrium where snowfall matches the ice lost. This allowed the calculation of how much more ice must be lost in order to regain stability. It is a very conservative rock-bottom minimum, said Professor Jason Box from the National Geographical Survey of Denmark and Greenland, who led the new research. Professor Jason Box added, "Realistically, we will see this figure more than double within this century." The 27-centimeter estimate is a minimum because it only accounts for global heating so far and because some ways in which glacier ice is lost at the margins of the ice sheet are not included. The advantage of this study is that it provides a solid estimate of inevitable sea level rise, but the method used does not give a timescale over which the ice will be lost. Nonetheless, based on scientists' overall understanding of how ice sheets such as Greenland lose ice into the ocean, the researchers said most of the rise would occur relatively soon. In 2021, other scientists warned that a significant part of the Greenland ice sheet was on the brink of a tipping point. The minimum of 27 centimeters is the sea level rise deficit that we have accrued to date, and it's going to get paid out no matter what we do going forward, said Dr. William Colgan. Also, at the National Geological Survey of Denmark and Greenland, Dr. William Colgan added, "Whether it's coming in 100 years or 150 years, it's coming, and the sea level rise we're committed to is growing at present because of the climate trajectory that we're on." Dr. William Colgan added, "If 2012 becomes a normal year, then the committed loss grows to 78 centimeters, which is staggering, and the fact that we're already flickering into the range of ice loss is shocking. But the difference between 78 centimeters and 27 centimeters highlights the difference that can be made through implementing the Paris Climate Accord. There is still a lot of room to minimize the damage." Mountain glaciers in the Himalayas and in the Alps are already on course to lose a third and a half of their ice respectively, while the West Antarctic ice sheet is also thought by some scientists to be past the point at which major losses are inevitable. Warming oceans also expand, adding to sea level rise. There is growing support in the scientific literature for multi-meter levels of sea level rise within the next 100 to 200 years, said Dr. William Colgan. A collapse of the colossal East Antarctic ice sheet, which would lead to a 52-meter rise in sea levels if it all melted, could be averted if rapid climate action is taken today. Professor Gail Whiteman at the University of Exeter in England, who was not part of the study team, said, "The results of this new study are hard to ignore for all business leaders and politicians concerned about the future of humanity. It is bad news for nearly 600 million people worldwide that live in coastal zones. As sea levels rise, they will be increasingly vulnerable, and it threatens approximately $1 trillion of global wealth. Professor Gail Whiteman added, political leaders must rapidly scale up funding for climate adaptation and damage. Sea level is rising faster today than for at least 3,000 years as mountain glaciers and the Greenland ice cap melt and ocean waters expand as they heat. Even a few meters of sea level rise will redraw the map of the world with profound consequences for millions of people in coastal cities from New York to Shanghai. The Greenland ice sheet, which could deliver 7 meters of sea level rise, is on the brink of a tipping point, after which accelerated melting would become inevitable, scientists warned back in 2021. While the full impact of melting ice is felt over centuries, researchers warned that the level of carbon emissions over the next few decades will lock in future sea level rise.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
This Friday prayer is a weekly event. When such a community exists where a large group of people in a city gather in a certain place every week, it can be a base, it can be a meeting place to discuss all the important issues of the society. When everyone is expected to gather together, people think of what things to say, societies have needs. There is everything from intellectual issues to social services, from their people's cooperation to their military mobilization for defending the country. All of these are realized and carried out in this continuous weekly gatherings. And these things come about. That is, they can come about. There is an opportunity of this importance and greatness in this gathering. Therefore, this is an enormous treasure and an extraordinary opportunity that has been given to us.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another feature of the Friday prayers is the combination of spirituality and politics. This is something that is rare for materialistic people and those who don't ponder over matters. How can politics, spirituality, and the belief in God exist in one place? Politics has a basis that in appearances is contradictory to the remembrance of Allah and the like. So mixing politics with spirituality in an obligatory act is a virtuosity that belongs to Islam. It's Islam's work of art. The following tradition has been narrated from Imam Ridha alayhi salam about the Friday prayer leader. He informs them of the prospects and fears that have come upon them, in which they will have both harm and benefit. This is an important, great matter. The events that are taking place in the world and that have a relationship with our society, either as a loss or a benefit, are expressed to the people by the Friday prayer leader. Let's consider the example of the issue of nuclear power. Or the war in Ukraine. This is an issue that is happening in the world, or there are different matters relating to the politics of the East and the West. These are things that affect our country, our society, our life, and our politics. Well, the Friday prayer leader explains, describes, and talks about these things for the people with sufficient and correct information. He links politics with spirituality. He says, "Be pious towards God." People must be reminded to practice piety in the Friday prayer sermon. At the same time, he explains politics to people. This kind of politics, international politics. This is also one of the issues that is one of Friday prayer's features. It has other features too, of course, which I have spoken about briefly.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.